I think today is going to be a real treat. We're in the middle of our series on the other apostles. We finished James last week, and this week we're going to begin our look at Peter. His given name was not Peter, but was Simon. His story begins with his brother Andrew, who was a disciple of John the Baptist. One day, John the Baptist was talking with Andrew and one of his other disciples, and John sees Jesus walking by. He points and says, "Look, the Lamb of God." Well, Andrew and the other disciple already know what that means. John the Baptist has been teaching about him. So Andrew and the other guy take off and chase Jesus down. Jesus says, "What are you looking for?" Isn't that interesting? Not who are you looking for, but what are you looking for? And Andrew and his friend say, "Teacher, where are you staying?" So Jesus invites him over. And the three of them talk all afternoon. And immediately afterwards, Andrew runs to tell his brother Simon that he's found the Messiah. Well, Simon, of course, goes back with his brother Andrew to meet Jesus. Jesus looks straight at Simon and says, "You are Simon, but you will be called Peter." Now, the gospel account doesn't tell us if Andrew told Jesus all about his brother Simon, but I suspect he has. Simon and Andrew are very close, and I suspect that by the end of that afternoon, Jesus had a pretty good feel for Simon's personality. And I think it might have been a moment like the ones we ourselves have when we meet someone and know within minutes that they are, quote, our tribe, so to speak. We walk straight into each other's hearts and lives, right? I think this was just such a moment. Jesus tends to give his friends nicknames, and the nickname he gives Simon would translate to our modern language as Rocky or Simon the Rock. And this tells us so much about how Jesus sees Peter's heart. Simon Peter doesn't follow Jesus right away, though. Apparently, he and Andrew continue working their family business, which is fishing the Sea of Galilee. Although they're from Bethsaida, which means house of fish, their home is in Capernaum, about 6 miles west. Here is a picture of the excavation of Peter's home in Capernaum from BiblePlaces.com. It doesn't look like this nowadays. Nowadays, there's a big church built over the top of it, and it's hard to see. I really don't like what they've done with it. But I don't know if you can tell, but the general layout of this home is almost circular, with a bunch of rooms on the outside that open onto a central shared area. Now, Simon Peter is married, and it's entirely possible that other families or relatives also live here. It's a pretty big house. In fact, it's possible, even probable, that Peter and Andrew's business partners live here. The brothers are in business with a man named Zebedee, his two sons, James and John, and Zebedee's very ambitious and pushy wife. In fact, I personally wonder if Peter might be married to one of Zebedee's daughters, because there's a story later about Jesus healing Peter's mother-in-law in this very house. At any rate, their fishing business is a big outfit because Zebedee not only has at least one boat himself, but he's got hired hands in addition to his two sons and his partners, Peter and Andrew. Now, these are not small fishing boats that you might be imagining. Here are the remains of a boat from the first century that was discovered on the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee in 1986. It's called the Jesus Boat. And here is a replica. You can see it is very large and would have held up to 15 passengers. So to own at least one boat like this and to own a large house means these fishermen were well-established businessmen. Peter's own call to discipleship seems to have come later in Jesus' ministry. Jesus is teaching by the Sea of Galilee, and the crowds are pressing in so hard that Jesus, looks around for a boat to get into. He spots two boats nearby that are pulled up on the beach while the fishermen wash their nets after a long night of fishing. And Jesus hops into one of the boats, which happens to be the boat belonging to Peter. Peter, at Jesus' request, pushes the boat out a bit, and Jesus sits and finishes his teaching. And when he's done, Jesus tells Peter to pull on out farther and let his nets down again. Now Peter has a decision to make. He and Andrew have just finished cleaning their nets after a fruitless night of fishing. But Peter pulls out anyway, and they let the nets back down. And of course, they catch so many fish, the nets start to break. They have to signal the other boats to come help them. Then Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and whoever is helping them, fill both boats with so many fish, the boats start to sink. This is the very picture of how God responds to us if we will just give him a chance. This is Jesus preaching the good news by showing it. Peter is utterly overwhelmed. He falls at Jesus' feet and says, "Go away from me, for I am a sinful man." But Jesus says, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be capturing men alive." Now, Andrew, of course, was already a disciple, but from that moment on, Peter, James, and John left everything and went and followed Jesus. I want to point out here that they all still keep doing their jobs as fishermen. Andrew was a disciple at first of John the Baptist and then Jesus, and he's still here fishing. There are several later references of using boats, these boats, to take Jesus places and of the same men fishing. It's just that they're now also and primarily followers of Jesus. Their hearts and lives have changed. When they're not fishing, they are walking alongside Jesus. And for sure, the time they spend with Jesus cuts into their fishing time and therefore their income. There is undoubtedly blowback from friends and family and society in general. Peter later says they've given up everything to follow Jesus. But Peter's wife, at least, is supportive because we know from the book of Acts that after the resurrection, she accompanies Peter on his missionary journeys. Peter, meanwhile, becomes a recognized leader among the disciples. When the temple leaders want to collect the annual temple tax from Jesus, it's Peter they approach. Peter knows Jesus doesn't have the money for the temple tax, but he tells them, sure, he'll pay it. And when Peter sees Jesus later, Jesus tells him to go cast a line in the water, and in the mouth of the first fish he catches will be the 4 drachma piece needed to cover both Jesus' tax and Peter's as well. And of course, that's exactly what happens. There are more stories about Peter than I can cover in the time we've got. I'm just trying to give you a sense of the man and a sense of the arc of his relationship with Jesus. Some of the stories about Peter, like this next one, are a bit controversial. Many of you know the story of the time Jesus sends the disciples ahead in a boat and a storm overtakes them during the night. Suddenly, the disciples see Jesus walking across the water to them. They think he's a ghost. But Peter, recognizing Jesus, says, "If it's really you, then call me to come to you." Jesus calls, and Peter walks on the water until he loses his nerve and Jesus grabs him as he starts to sink. This story about Jesus walking on the water is also in Mark and John, in addition to Matthew, but neither the Mark or John version mentioned Peter at all, which is a pretty glaring omission, right? Since Mark's version is the earliest, Matthew's version, the one with Peter, would have been written sometime later. So I think Matthew's version, the only one that has this bit about Peter in it, may have been embroidered during the intervening time. So, although it totally fits Peter's personality, I'm not quite sure about this part of that story. Nevertheless, by all accounts, Peter is present most of the time in the stories where the disciples are mentioned. One of the most important of these moments is recorded in all three synoptic gospels. This likely did happen. Jesus has apparently become aware he will have to go to Jerusalem and allow himself to be killed there. This is not a small thing for Jesus to wrestle with, and he needs to know that his best friends, his disciples, understand so they don't panic when the time comes. But also, I think Jesus needs to know that they're going to be there for him. Jesus is human. He needs his friends, and he needs to know that he's not wasted his time, that his message is somehow making it through to these thick-headed disciples, and that they will carry it forward after his death. So he asks his disciples, "Who do the people say that I am?" And the disciples tell him, "Well, some folks say you're John the Baptist raised from the dead." John the Baptist had been beheaded by this time. "Others say you're Elijah, who is prophesied to come before the Messiah comes." While other people say you're Jeremiah or one of the other prophets who has come back to life. Jesus digests this a bit and says, "But who do you say that I am?" I imagine there's a pause as the disciples shift their eyes to each other. Who dares to answer this? These men have demonstrated over and over that they really don't get it, and Jesus has not been shy about scolding them over it. I bet they look at Peter, the leader among them. Peter bites the bullet and says the quiet part out loud. He says, "You are the Messiah, Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, Mark and Luke's accounts stop here, but Matthew adds another bit. In Matthew's account, Jesus goes on to say, "Oh, bless you, Peter, for you don't know this because someone told it to you, but because it has been revealed to you by my Father in heaven. And I'll tell you something else," Jesus says. "You are Peter the rock, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind up on earth will be bound up in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." I can't even imagine what Peter was feeling or thinking after this, but he certainly didn't have time to get a swelled head because the very next minute, Jesus starts telling the disciples about how he's going to have to go to Jerusalem and suffer and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And Peter pulls Jesus aside and says, "That can't be right, Jesus. Those things could never happen to you." You see, Peter still thinks that Jesus, as the Messiah, is going to bring an army to crush the Romans. That's what, quote, being saved means to the Jews of this time. But Jesus says sharply, "Get thee behind me, Satan. You are a rock of stumbling to me. You are looking at this from a human point of view, not God's point of view." Poor Peter. First he gets the keys to the kingdom, and the next second he's Satan. Talk about whiplash. Not long after this, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up on a nearby mountain where the three disciples watch in amazement as Jesus is transfigured before them. His clothes shine a bright white, and they see him talking with Elijah and Moses. Well, Peter cannot contain himself. Even though he is beside himself with fright, he manages to stutter, "Lord, let us put up tents for each of you." Jesus doesn't answer. God says from a cloud, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." I think God just told Peter just to sit down and shut up, right? And then suddenly, no one is there except the disciples and Jesus. And they all make their way down the mountain. Can you imagine? Peter's head must be spinning. When the time does come for Jesus to go to Jerusalem, it is Peter and John the disciple, whom Jesus loved especially, whom he sends to find and prepare the room for his final supper. And as that meal is beginning, it is Peter who protests that Jesus should not be the one washing the feet of the disciples. It should be the other way around. And Jesus tells Peter, "I know you don't understand this right now, but later you'll get it." But Peter, horrified that Jesus would do such a lowly task, says, Oh, heck no, I'll never let you wash my feet." Jesus rocks back on his heels and says, "Well, if I do not wash you, you'll have no share or portion or inheritance with me." Peter is stricken. He says, "Okay, then, I'm all in. Wash my feet, wash my hands, wash my head." I bet everybody cracks up at this. And Jesus says, "No, Peter, anyone who is fully washed has no need for all that. You're clean already." Well, most of you. Jesus is obviously thinking of Judas here. So Peter allows Jesus to wash his feet. And when Jesus finishes washing all of the disciples' feet, he explains that this is how he wants them to treat each other, as if they were the lowliest servant caring for each other's comfort and needs. As the supper progresses, Jesus tells the disciples that one of them will betray him. They are dumbfounded. John, the disciple Jesus loves, Peter's good friend and business partner, is sitting right next to Jesus. So Peter motions him to ask Jesus who it is that will betray him. And of course, it is Judas. After Judas leaves, Jesus tells the disciples, "All right, it's time. I will only be with you a little while longer, and where I am going, you do not have the power to come, even though you will look for me. Love each other in the same way I have loved you. This is how people will know you're my disciples, from the love between you." Peter's like, wait, where are you going?" And Jesus says again, "You do not have the power to accompany me now, but you will follow me later." And Peter says, "Why don't I have the power to follow you now? I will lay my life down for you." And Jesus says, "Really? I'll tell you the truth. Because before this night is out, before the cock crows, you will disown me three times." I imagine Peter's jaw drops. He must be flabbergasted. He cannot imagine a scenario in which he would disown Jesus, particularly not three times before this very night is over. In Luke's account, Jesus tells Peter, "Simon, Simon, Satan has demanded to sift all of you like wheat, but I have prayed earnestly for you personally, that your faith may not fail, and that you, when you return, will strengthen your brothers. After this, Jesus speaks to the disciples for a long time about what is to come and how they're to handle it, and he tells them about the Holy Spirit coming to teach them and remind them of all he said. And then he prays over them and asks God to protect them. And then they all leave the upper room and hike over to the Mount of Olives, where they've probably been camping over there. And when they arrive, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John and goes into the Garden of Gethsemane. There, Jesus becomes deeply grieved and distressed, and he says to them, "My soul is sad to the point of death. Please stay here with me and keep watch." Now, we always think of Jesus' agony as being focused on his imminent torture and death, but the word used here is sadness. Jesus is sad to the point of death. I wonder if he is feeling how any of us would feel if we know we are about to die and will not see our loved ones again this side of heaven, if we know they're in danger, but we have to leave them. After going a little farther away, Jesus falls to the ground face down and prays, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, please let this cup pass by me. Even so, I want to do your will, not mine." In his agony, Jesus goes back for support from his closest friends, Peter, James, and John, only to find them asleep, having drowsed off after that big meal. And Jesus says to Peter, "Can't you even stay awake 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you will not be tempted, for the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." I think we often miss that these words were directed to Peter in particular. Jesus knows that Peter wants to remain faithful, but he also knows Peter may buckle under the events of this night. He tells Peter to pray, pray, pray that he does not fall into temptation. Jesus steps aside again to pray and returns again to find them dozing off again. This happens 3 times until finally Jesus says, "Enough already. Look, it's time for the Son of Man to be delivered into the hands of the sinful." And they look up to see a mob coming towards them with swords and clubs. Judas gives the signs to the guards by greeting Jesus with a kiss. It is a crowd handpicked by the chief priests and lawyer scribes and elders. As the temple guards arrest Jesus, Jesus says, "Am I such a one that it was really necessary to come like this, bringing swords and clubs? You couldn't have arrested me at any time while I was preaching in the temple." But of course, they couldn't have, because Jesus was revered among the people. They were afraid the people would riot. This power play had to be done in secret so they can spin the story however they wish. Well, Peter isn't having any of it. He grabs a sword, attacks one of the men who happens to be a servant of the high priest. The guy dodges him, and Peter only succeeds in slicing off his ear. Jesus responds, "Enough of this." He touches the man's ear and heals it. All of the disciples cut and run, even Peter. But it is Peter alone who eventually turns back and trails along at a distance to see what will become of Jesus. Jesus is taken to the house of the high priest. It's late at night and cold, so someone starts a fire in the courtyard and everyone huddles around it, including Peter, who is trying to be as small and inconspicuous as possible. One of the servants says, "Wait a minute, you were with him." And Peter says, "No, I don't know him, woman." And a little later, someone else says, "You are one of them." And Peter says, "No, man, I'm not." And about an hour later, Another person insists, I know this guy was with him because he's a Galilean. And Peter says, man, I don't know what you're talking about. And as he is speaking, the cock crows. And Peter remembers that Jesus said he'd betray him three times before the night was out. Peter is devastated. He goes outside and weeps bitterly. I don't know how much more of this evening's events Peter misses in his anguish of soul. He's not mentioned again until after the resurrection. He is, I'm sure, in a very dark place these next 3 days, but thankfully he sticks with the other disciples. They are all probably in hiding. The morning after the crucifixion, the women go to properly tend to Jesus' poor, tortured body. But when they get there, an angel tells them he's not there and to go tell the disciples and Peter. Mark's gospel specifically says the angel names Peter as the one they need to tell. And when the women come to tell them that Jesus is risen, the other disciples don't believe him, but Peter jumps up and runs to the tomb. Bless his heart. Can you imagine the hope alternating with the despair that he must have felt? John also runs, and in John's version of the gospel, he beats Peter to the tomb but doesn't go in. It is Peter, by all accounts, who goes straight in and sees the strips of linen used to wrap Jesus and the cloth that had been used to cover his face, all lying there neatly folded in the empty tomb. In the 40 days after his resurrection and his appearance to Mary Magdalene and the other women at the tomb, Jesus appears to the disciples and to many other people many times. But in 1 Corinthians 15:5, he appears to Peter first, then to the other disciples. My favorite Jesus encounter happens one night after the resurrection and after Jesus has already appeared to the disciples. Jesus apparently didn't hang out with his disciples much after the resurrection. He'd show up and then disappear. It must have been disconcerting and a bit frustrating for the disciples. So on this particular night, Peter, James, and John, and four other disciples are sitting around, and Peter says, I don't know about you guys, but I'm going fishing. So they all hop in the boat and fish all night, catching nothing. As day breaks, some guy on shore hollers out to them, have you caught anything? And they say, no. And the guy says, cast your net on the right-hand side of the boat and you'll find fish there. And when they do, they catch so many fish they can't even haul the net into the boat. John looks at Peter and says, that's the Lord. And as soon as John utters those words, Peter knows it's true. He grabs his cloak and dives into the water, swimming as hard as he can. The rest of the disciples bring the boat to shore, dragging the net full of fish. When they get there, they find Jesus has breakfast already roasting on the fire. He says, bring some of the fish you caught. And Peter immediately hops up, gets back in the boat, drags the heavy net ashore, and they all have breakfast together. I want to pause here for a second and talk about the Peter we are coming to know and love. If I were going to place Peter on the Enneagram chart, I'd place him as an Enneagram 2, the helper. According to the Enneagram Institute, quote, twos are empathetic, sincere, and warm-hearted. They are friendly, generous, and self-sacrificing, but can also be sentimental, flattering, and people-pleasing. They are well-meaning and driven to be close to others, but can slip into doing things for others in order to be needed. Wow, that sounds exactly like Peter, doesn't it? Quote, at their best, Enneagram twos are unselfish and altruistic and have unconditional love for others. Their basic desire is to feel loved, and their basic fear is being unwanted and unworthy of being loved. Let that land in your heart for a moment. Look at Peter's greatest need and his greatest fear, the fear of being unwanted and unworthy of being loved. Knowing this, look at what Jesus says to brokenhearted, hopeful Peter. Jesus says, "Do you love me? Agape love, generous love without strings attached?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord, I love you like a brother." Poor Peter, his confidence in his faith and in his love has been shaken so badly he can no longer trust himself. He can no longer claim to love Jesus unreservedly like he did at the Last Supper, like he spoke with his mouth, because now he knows his own weakness and false heart. He can only say, "I love you," with philo, brotherly love. And Jesus says, "Feed my lambs." Then Jesus asked Peter a second time, "Do you agape love me? Unconditionally." And Peter answers once again, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you like a brother." And Jesus says, "Shepherd my sheep." I imagine Peter is weeping by this time. One last time, Jesus asks, but this time, Jesus says, "Peter, do you love me with a brotherly love?" And Peter is in great distress because Jesus says it this way. Peter says, "Lord, you know all things. You know I love you like a brother." And Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." Poor Peter, it is so hard to face yourself honestly and know that when push comes to shove, you have already and may in the future fail your Lord. But Jesus responds by meeting Peter where he is. And even in the depths of Peter's shame, Peter hears Jesus ask him to feed and shepherd his people. Jesus is restoring Peter to his leadership role among the disciples and their ministry. We'll pick up Peter's story here next week. In our breakout groups, let's reflect on this beautiful soul and his journey of faith. Ooh, that story is intense. I can't wait to hear what you thought about the story today, about what you learned about Peter. There were really two questions. It was like, what insights did you gain into Peter, if any? And what do you think he might write to persecuted Christians as he went around on his missionary journeys? So either or both, talk to me about what you came up with.
I was telling my group how when I was in Bible college, and you know, we're talking a conservative Baptist Bible college, in one of our classes we had to write a paper comparing ourselves to a character in the Bible. And of course, most of the women, being a conservative Baptist school, most of the women wrote, you know, comparing themselves to Lydia or Tabitha or Ruth or, you know, whatever. Not me. I grabbed right onto Peter because Peter and I are cut from the same cloth.
Oh, how fun.
And I always thought it was wild that Peter... I always thought my personality was too feminine for somebody like Peter. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the one thing that I learned today, I learned from Woody when he mentioned the anagrams, and I went, oh yeah, I did learn that. Because I've never, I mean, I've heard of them, but I've never done them. And he asked me if I was a number two, and I said, I honestly have never done the test, so I don't know, but I'm pretty sure I am, because my basic need in my life, the thing that I want more than anything else, is to be loved and accepted. And like I'm you know, going through what I'm going through right now with my estrangement, and it's killing me. But because that's the one thing I want more than anything, is that unconditional love that I feel like, as a mom, we give our kids, and our kids should give it back, but it doesn't work that way. But yeah, it's Peter, and I also think Peter was very ADHD. Is
He
very
does sound rather impetuous, doesn't he? And not sit still
very
for much.
spontaneous. I
He
mean, you
doesn't
know,
sit still.
first thing he did was grab that sword and defend his lord, you know,
Grab his coat, jump in the water, right?
yeah, I mean, and that's me. I'm like, oh, something needs to be done, let's get it
Let's
done.
get
But yet at the same time, I will kind of shrink back and like hide, and oh, I don't want to be in the middle of all that, you know. So yeah, I identify with Peter greatly.
Cool.
I never thought about Peter that way. And it's like, I agree. I'm kind of a Peter because if I see something going on, I don't think about it. I just jump in with both feet.
Are you a justice warrior, Renee?
Huh?
Are you a justice warrior? If you see something and you feel like it's an
Yes.
injustice,
I
your
am.
mouth, you're there, you gotta, I, this is not right. I'm a social justice warrior, and I think that in today's society, that's what Peter would have been.
I am the same, and I want to tell y'all that Martha said the word impetuous. I'm sorry, Martha, if I'm revealing that, and I disagreed, which is funny. I was like, okay, now that you guys have talked about ADHD and the impetuousness, I'm like, okay, yeah, I disagreed, and maybe he is.
He
I don't
just,
know.
he was a guy of action.
I just see a man who screwed up and was humble enough, and vulnerable enough to say it and to keep going back and trying to show up for the Lord.
And that's what I think his message would be to people. It's just, you know, don't lose hope, and you can be forgiven. You know, over and over, you can be forgiven. Keep your faith, keep your hope, keep hope alive. That's the message I think he would give them. Be strong.
And isn't it interesting?
And forgive yourself too.
Yeah,
Yes.
wasn't that be a that was he then that's what he was struggling with there at the end, wasn't he? I
Well,
think
who
it's interesting that
started?
Peter being the rock of the church, and then all the popes take their lineage back to their papal authority back to Peter. And forgiveness within the church, within the Catholic Church, is an embodied experience where the sacrament of confession is expected to need to be a recurring thing. That you actually act out this forgiveness and actually receive it.
Right. Right. And to Lumar's point about Peter's message might be just keep going back. Just keep going back. Doesn't matter. We're human. Come back. Forgiveness is available. So I'm not sure anybody else might, in a scholarly way, make the point that I'm making, but it does
You see the root,
resonate
that
with
you
me a
see
little
the
bit.
roots, right?
I do. I do.
Very cool. What
Well,
other observation?
I think that forgiveness of yourself is really important because you don't get stuck somewhere. I've seen people who they just get stuck in their guilt, and it makes it difficult for them to move beyond and grow more. And I think that this opportunity that Jesus gave to Peter to really accept his denial of Jesus and move on, not stay stuck in the fact that he did not do what he said he was going to do. And I think we can all learn from that because, gosh, I make mistakes all of the time. And I really like the idea that I don't have to stay in that thought, that I can forgive myself and move on and try and do better the next time. What have I learned from this experience? How can this make me a better Christian? How can I be more thoughtful to other people in the world? I just, it's a beautiful thing to have that forgiveness.
Who in our group made the parallel, the connection, Peter and Jesus, David and God? Who was that I sent out?
Did
Julia, you want to mention that?
well, we were talking about quite a bit with Peter and how impetuous he was, but how he sought to be with Jesus all the time. And I was thinking that's how David was with God. David was yearning for God. He kept faltering and he would yearn for God. And I was thinking it was similar to Peter wanting to be, I think someone had said in our group, his BFF, Jesus's BFF, right there. Yet he would have to step back a little. But he still wanted to be right there with Jesus. But he kept wondering if he was overstepping and stepping back a little bit and trying to remind himself that it wasn't about him, it was about Jesus. And it just drew a corollary between David and God and their relationship, and Peter and his relationship with Jesus.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I think I just get tickled every time I read John throwing in John, the disciple Jesus loved, or John, the one Jesus liked best, or John, who outran Peter to the tomb, but I didn't go in. And John, it would be another hilarious, it would just be so fun to study his personality. But Peter's comes across so clearly. We know more about Peter than any of them, I think. Right?
And
Speaking of
Anne had a question about your question number two. Would you like to address that, Anne?
Do it, Anne.
Go for it.
So your question is worded as Peter, an apostle like Paul, right? Is that how it's worded? Yep. When Paul came later, and Peter was there first, so it should have been the opposite. It should be Paul, an apostle like
That's
Peter.
true. That's true. That's true.
I like that.
I still think
Peter was
Paul's a
there
little.
first, and I think Paul would say that. And Peter and Paul knew each other well, and their paths crossed many times on their missionary journeys and in meetings. And Peter struggled much more with being a Jew and how that translates into as being a Christian. Paul pretty much got it clear in his head, it feels like to me. Whereas Peter leads from the heart, doesn't he? Peter can understand something in his mind, but he leads from the heart. It's the heart. And so and we may actually talk about this next week because we have a little more that part of Peter's story we're going to go over, the missionary part, and we'll see how he and Paul interact. But Peter does fall into that weakness of the Enneagram 2 and wanting to fit in with the group. And there's an incident where he kind of shades into sitting at the table with the Jewish faction and trying to please the Jewish faction and acting like the folks in the Jew, there were Jewish factions within the Christian church, okay, early communities. And so, and Paul walks in, sees it, and says, "Oh, heck no," and calls Peter down, you know. And Peter responds with humility. I don't think Peter ever actually gets over his denial of Christ. And I think that's in a good way. I think that made Peter humble in a way that he never forgot.
But there were several occasions when Peter was jealous. He was the one who was always like, "Oh, yo, who's your favorite? Who's your favorite?" And then I mentioned
No,
that.
that was James and John. Yeah.
Well, but remember when Mary was washing Christ's feet?
Yeah.
And didn't he say, like, "What's she doing here?"
I don't remember if that was Peter. Was that Peter?
I
I
thought it
don't.
was Peter.
I
I
know
don't
Judith
think it
said
was Peter.
something.
Well,
Yeah.
according to Jesus Christ Superstar, it was Judas.
No. Let me look it up.
Well, because Judas kept the purse, and Judas was the one who said, "We could use that money for something else."
Now that did happen. That actually that does happen. Luke 7:36. Let's take a quick look at that story. I think that particular story happens in two places in the gospel. Went to the Pharisees, woman weeping and anointing him. I hear here's the confusion. The person that Jesus speaks to is named Simon. Simon is the one who owned that house, but it was not Simon Peter, it was Simon the Pharisee. Different
Oh.
person. And then there's another place where Mary takes ointment, and that's in like all the gospels. Let me double check those. Matthew 26:6. Let's take a quick look at that one. 26:6. Jesus is in Bethany, Simon the leper. Perfume could have been given to the poor. And that's what made Judas Iscariot mad. Okay, well, that did not mention me either. Mark 14:3. Let's look at that one. Mark 14:3. He's in Bethany, home of Simon the leper. Obviously, Simon has been cured. He's still called Simon the leper, but everybody's at his house. So, this must have been somebody Jesus had healed. Some of those present, so it's basically the same story that Matthew copied. And then the last chance we've got is John 12:1. And let's look at his version. John's version is often different. And John, Mary, this was Mary, the sister of Martha, at their house, and she was the one who poured the ointment. Judas is named as the one who objected. So that's those stories.
Something that I had not thought about that you in what you mentioned, and I believe Lou Marr mentioned this in our breakout, was that all of these people kept their jobs. They kept fishing. And
Exactly. We don't think of that, right?
I know. And somebody said that at least initially, this being a disciple was a side gig. No, I'm sorry, a side hustle. A side
Yes.
hustle.
That's
I
right.
said
It has been a long time.
that. In talking to a friend recently, we talked about whether or not the disciples, were working or how did they have the money to travel. And then we also talked about what happened to their wife and kids and all that. And we thought they probably did go with. But the reason it wasn't mentioned was because, context, women and children had no status. So they wouldn't have been mentioned. But it was interesting to think about them keeping their jobs, and especially as big businessmen, really successful businessmen.
And also, I don't know if you picked up on this, but the business of fishing is a night job. They fish overnight. And
Oh, I thought they fished overnight to avoid the authorities because they weren't paying taxes or something.
I'm pretty sure they fish overnight because of the fish, but maybe I'm wrong.
No,
I
that
could
makes
be
sense.
wrong.
That makes sense. When my dad used to go fishing, he would go fishing early in the morning or late at night because that's when the fish eat.
Yes, according to my father, when we would go camping and he woke us up at 3:30 in the morning, he told us the fish bite at 4.
Wow.
My dad was a sunrise fisherman. It was like, gotta get up with the sun so you can fish and get fish. And it's like, okay, Dad, I don't want to sleep.
Gail, you mentioned that that Peter leads from the heart, and Paul certainly wrote in a very intellectual way. And your second question is, what's he going to say to the believers in Rome who are undergoing persecution? It's been a long time since I've read the letters of Peter. It's going to be very interesting to hear whether or not that's what he leads with in those letters.
And actually, when you read them, First Peter is the only one that he wrote. Second Peter, very unlikely that he wrote that one. So when you leave this class and go to your Bible, First Peter is just a really short little letter. Leave this discussion and go read First Peter. See what you think. Jot some notes for next week when we cover that. It'll be interesting.
Paul's personality being what it was, and Peter's personality being what it was, that Peter probably drove Paul nuts.
Yes, and vice versa. I imagine I kind of imagine Peter holding Paul at arm's length so he doesn't like hurt him, But they were very much in partnership as leaders of the early church. When Paul got called on the carpet about his ministry to the Gentiles, Peter's the one who Peter goes to bat for him. I mean, and this is even after the other incident. It's just they work hard together.
But they also had different gifts because I think Paul had the gift of evangelism, whereas Peter had the gift of teaching. And
We have a little bit about Peter's ministry, and we're going to go over that next week. We're going to finish out his story. But the thing that strikes me in his ministry is the miracles just everywhere he went. It was just amazing. He
But
was so hands-on,
Jesus called him to feed the sheep. He called him to be the shepherd. In other words, the pastor. I mean, his job, his God-given job was to look after the sheep, to look after the children, the baby Christians, help guide them. And I mean, Paul's main job was to preach the gospel. But Peter's job was a little
As a
more
pastor
intimate.
more,
I think also that Paul's main focus was trying to get other people that may not have heard Jesus or may not have heard what happened, because I mean, it wasn't like it was on TV, to the
Yeah, he
different
went to the
people.
Jewish synagogues primarily first.
And then I think Paul was trying to get the word out to other people that, hey, Jesus existed and this is what happened. He was more of a, don't know what the word is. He was more of the get to people and tell them what's going on and tell them what happened. And then Peter would come along and go, okay, this is how you do it.
I think they both had a lot of this is how you do it in it. But yes, it's very interesting to compare and contrast their ministries. We know a lot more about Paul's than we do about Peter's, but we do have quite a bit about Peter's. Anne,
That's
did
cool.
you have a comment? I saw your hand go up.
I have a question. Were any of the disciples rabbis?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I think they were all uneducated.
So why did Christ gather the uneducated rather than because I know like the rabbis that we have here, their main job is study.
Yes, well, there's one good reason for that, and that is rabbis didn't come into really being as a group called rabbis, as we think of rabbis, until after 70 Common Era, when the temple fell and there was no sacrificial system anymore. That's when the rabbis became important and became kind of a thing. Prior to that, the word rabbi meant just teacher. And teacher. It could be an itinerant, you know, traveling preacher. There's lots and lots and lots of those at this time. Jesus is one. And Jesus did actually come to the people in power, the religious leaders in power. Those were the Pharisees and the scribe lawyers. Okay, they were the the Sadducees, for that matter. Though he did come to them, and they was like weren't having any of it, except for one or two, like Nicodemus.
So to answer Anne's question, it seems to me that the educated people, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, would have, by virtue of their education, perhaps, they would have been committed to a certain belief, and they would not have been open to something totally different.
Right. They had a lot to lose.
There were a couple of disciples that were educated, weren't there?
Pardon?
There were a couple of disciples that were educated, were there not? Wasn't like Luke a physician?
Luke may have been a physician. There is a reference to Luke being a physician. We don't know if it was that Luke for sure, but we do traditionally attribute Luke as being a physician and educated. He wrote all these books. He wrote a massive volume of books, so he was educated. John, who was more mystical, he's the one that we get the Lamb of God imagery from. He's the one who sees Jesus kind of high and lifted up. He's very, very ethereal in how he sees Jesus spiritually more than the physical version of Jesus. Whereas Peter is always going to be a boots on the ground guy, right? He's our meat and potatoes guy.
Was Peter educated well enough to write his own letters?
Unlikely. Unlikely. In fact, in one of them, he mentions that Silas helped him. In his letter, he mentions that Silas helped him with it.
Yeah.
So I think it's entirely possible Peter could neither read nor write.
Because fishermen didn't need to do that.
Right.
I wonder what Paul thought of Peter and Peter thought of Paul relative to their education and their social standings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whether it was
Paul had a Ivy League education.
Right.
The best that was possible to have.
And used it in his work.
Yes, he did. He used not only the fruit of his education, he used his status in his work. He would call out his status as credentials.
Just fascinating to think about how status and privilege and education relate over the centuries to who held the pulpit.
Right.
Methodists had to sort out education requirements and still have, we treat licensed local pastors who don't have college degrees and who have authority within their churches very differently in terms of their voice and vote in annual conference and those sorts of things. And education came up a lot in the Methodist tradition as to value it or not, to require it or not.
Yes. And it brings to mind Mother Teresa. You know, I mean, like, you don't need an education. I mean, I have no idea what education she did or did not have, but she didn't need education to be humble and to impact the world like she did. Whereas Gandhi was highly educated and impacted the world from where he was. I think that the impact on the world is God's work, not our work. And that Peter's message, we're going to wind up here, but Peter's message is that you cannot fail God. Because God will not fail you. You are called to be humble. You are called to welcome the love and forgiveness that God has for you. And all of the rest of it, God will do. So let's stop there for today. And we'll go to First Peter next week. Love you.
Love y'all.
I'll miss that
Bye.
one. I'll have to catch up on the video.
Okay,
Thank
we'll
you.
miss you.
Okay. Bye.
Yep. Bye.